Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of Chapter 17 from the National Academy of Sports Medicine's Essentials of Personal Fitness Training textbook. We are here to go over the PowerPoint lecture for the nutrition chapter. So just to kind of point out before we get into this PowerPoint lecture, the specifics behind NASM and what they believe on nutrition is very government-based, count your calories, calories in, calories out sort of theory. And although I may not 100% agree that is the best theory behind weight loss and muscle gain and different things of that nature, I'm going to teach this to their exact parameters in a sense to best prepare you for the exam. So clicking over to slide two, so the objectives for this chapter are to describe the macronutrients and their functions, describe how the macronutrient composition of an individual's food intake can affect satiety, compliance, daily energy expenditure, and weight control, provide basic nutritional recommendations for optimizing health, and dispel myths. All right, clicking over to slide three, we have a definition of nutrition. So the definition of nutrition is the sum of the processes by which an animal or plant takes in and uses food substances. And the benefits of proper nutrition, which I'm sure we all know, improve the recovery of a muscle tissue damage due to exercise, improve health and athletic performance, decrease risk of disease and illness, and increase energy levels, as well as alter body composition. Clicking over to slide four. So, standards of practice. Basically, as personal trainers, we are not allowed to create meal plans, counsel our clients, and provide rehab or treatment of any injury or whatnot. So basically, they're going to go over exactly what we should, what exactly our scope of practice is. So personal trainers should be familiar with the concepts of nutrition. Integrating nutritional strategies with exercise will help clients achieve their desired outcomes. The professional legally qualified to practice in the field of nutrition is called a registered dietitian. So when NASM on the test, they might say, oh, who is legally registered or qualified to work in the field of nutrition? They might say a nutritionist or a licensed nutritionist. That is not the correct answer. Typically, it's a registered dietitian. According to NASM, it is a registered dietitian, which they're registered with the state, and we are not a registered dietitian. Even though you can give nutritional advice to your clients beyond our scope of practice, NASM does not recommend doing so to keep, we'll say, within our legal bounds. So the registered dietitian is a specialized food and nutrition expert with extensive training who meets specified criteria. Typically, it takes about 6 to 7 years to become a registered dietitian and requires a bachelor's as well as a master's in nutrition with internship hours and things of that nature. So looking to slide five, they begin to talk about energy and body composition. So by 2015, public health experts expect that 75% of all U.S. adults will either be overweight or obese. And actually, it has stayed about the same. So this was probably written about, we'll say, four or so years ago. And it's actually stayed about the same at about 66% of the population is overweight. It has relatively slowed down, but we do still have an obesity epidemic and a lot of people are overweight. And that's strictly based on the BMI categories, though. So you might have someone that has a BMI over, we'll say, 25, which puts them in the overweight category, but they might not even look that overweight or be overweight. Maybe they have a lot of muscle. So the facts about weight loss and weight gain are quite simple. So this is according to NASM. Eat fewer calories than are expended, and there will be a reduction in weight. Conversely, consume more calories than are expended, and there will be an increase in weight. This is known as the law of thermodynamics. That right there is something that you need to know for the test. Basically, calories in is greater than calories out. That means weight gain. Calories out greater than calories in. That means weight loss. That law right there is known as the law of thermodynamics. That's something very important to know for the test. So clicking over to slide six, we have daily energy needs. They're going to talk about how we describe a calorie. A lowercase c, or the original calorie, is a unit of energy that is defined as the amount of heat energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of water 1 degree Celsius. So what we deal in is actually the uppercase C, or what's called a kilocalorie. And you'll notice that because on the back of our nutrition labels, it'll say kcal. And that is equal to 1,000 of the lowercase c's, or actual calories. So also we want to understand what estimated total energy expenditure is, which is estimating how much energy we burn per day, as well as total daily energy expenditure, which is TDEE. and that is defined as the amount of energy spent on average in a typical day. Clicking over to slide 7, daily energy needs. So total energy expenditure is actually the sum total of three different energy components. These really aren't that important, but I'll go ahead and go over them. Resting metabolic rate is basically what your body burns as far as calories at rest, which is about 70% of your total energy per day. Thermic effect of food, which is basically the amount of calories that you burn just digesting food, solely digesting food, which is typically about 10% of the calories that you intake. Protein actually increases that to more like 20 to 30% of total energy expenditure, or sorry, of the thermic effect of food. So energy expenditure during physical activity typically makes up for 20% of total energy expenditure, or total daily energy expenditure. Clicking over to slide 8. All right, now we get into the fun stuff. So the macronutrients, which you do need to know just in general and for your clients and even, yeah, for the test, the three macronutrients are proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. Also, NASM considers water a macronutrient, even though it doesn't have any energy, so we don't really need to worry about that. If whenever they talk about macronutrients, just know your proteins, carbs, and fats. All right, first we're going to start with protein, clicking over to slide 9. Function: build and repair body tissues and structures, synthesize hormones, enzymes, and regulatory peptides, and can be used for energy in a low-carbohydrate diet. Your body hates using protein as a fuel source, so typically it chooses not to. Really, the only time that your body uses protein as a fuel source is when you're on an extremely low-calorie diet. And what you'll notice is that when you're on an extremely low-calorie diet, what your body does is it actually breaks down muscle protein and uses it as energy, because you need to find energy from somewhere, and the fat by itself is not kicking it. So when you're on an extremely low-calorie diet, which is basically anything under your total energy expenditure of the day, you actually do utilize protein as a fuel source. If you're eating a high-fat and relatively high-protein diet with a very low-carb diet, you typically tend to function almost 100% from fat. So for them to really say that your body uses protein as a fuel source when you're on a low-carbohydrate diet, not quite true. This is why typically lower-carbohydrate diets do work for fat loss and retention of muscle. Also, something important to know at the bottom of slide 9 is that protein provides 4 calories per gram. So there are 4 calories in 1 gram of protein. That's something that you do need to know for the test and is a direct test question. Clicking over to slide number 10. So what is protein made up of? They're made up of amino acids linked together by peptide bonds. And a peptide bond just refers to a link of amino acid. 2 amino acids together are a dipeptide. So protein strands are initially broken down in the stomach, winky smiley. You do need to know that protein, the digestion of protein initially begins in the stomach. And yeah, protein strands are initially broken down in the stomach, in which they are reduced to peptide bonds and then individual amino acids. After the stomach, then it goes into the small intestine, in which they're broken down into individual amino acids even further and then absorbed. The body uses about 20 amino acids to build different proteins. Clicking over to slide 11, there are 2 types of amino acids. There are essential and non-essential. You do need to know this more for the field and more to just to understand, we'll say maybe, what you can eat that it has essential amino acids and what that you eat that has non-essential amino acids. So essential amino acids cannot be manufactured in the body, meaning that you need to get essential amino acids in your food. So the way that I say that is they are essential to your diet, and they must be obtained through food or supplementation. Yes. Non-essential amino acids your body actually makes. An example of a non-essential amino acid would be something like glutamine. Essential amino acids would be your branched chain amino acids, things like leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And there are a few others too. So clicking over to the next slide, slide 12, there are complete proteins and incomplete proteins. I like to give this to my clients as the example of what their food or what types of foods they should be eating. And typically I point them in the direction of complete proteins, as they don't need to mix foods in order to get their full protein profile. Complete proteins are foods that supplies all essential amino acids in one type of food. All meat or animal product, we'll say, or any part of an animal typically contains all amino acids. Yeah, so meat, poultry, fish, dairy. Dairy actually does have all the complete proteins as well. So when vegetarians drink milk or cheese, add things of that nature, they do get their complete proteins. Incomplete proteins are things that are lacking in one or more essential amino acids, things like vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, most of the time nuts and seeds are lacking in one or two as well. So clicking over to slide 13, factors affecting protein requirements. If you exercise more, you need more protein, period. It increases the oxidation of amino acids and increases the amount of protein used to develop lean body mass during recovery. My recommendations fall somewhere around at least 1 gram per pound of protein. NASM will be a lot lower, but we'll get into that further down the road. So caloric intake, carbohydrates are often referred to as protein sparing, okay? Because in adequate amounts, protein will not be used as energy. It's important to understand that this is a core belief of NASM, and they do tend to bring it up on the test, is that carbohydrates are referred to as protein sparing. And what that means is basically, if your body has the option to use either carbohydrates or protein, and they're both available, it will always choose carbohydrates. And that is true. So eating carbohydrates before and after workouts can be just as important as eating protein. Clicking over to slide 14, protein intake requirements. So NASM recommends, and this is actually just taken straight out of the ADA or American Dietetics Association, or USGA, whichever makes those, 10 to 35% of total caloric intake is generally recommended. And the sedentary adult needs 0.8 grams per kilogram of protein per day. NASM will ask you that on the test. The total amount of protein a sedentary adult needs is 0.8 grams per kilogram of protein per day. Notice in the chart down below, recommended protein intakes, you have the sedentary adult, 0.8 grams of per kilogram. Strength athletes need more, and endurance athletes need more as well. Clicking over to high protein diets. So here's some things that they might be trying to bust myths and that sort of thing. If you are a strength, or if you train for strength and want to gain muscle, protein is going to be essential, and a decent amount of protein is very important. Typically, though, much above 35% of total calories, it's going to be difficult to really utilize all that protein. But keeping in mind that what I typically do is say don't eat more than 2 grams per pound. Not that it's a bad thing to eat more than that, just say you probably won't be able to utilize much more than 2 grams per pound of your own body weight. So to read this slide, slide 15, people participating in physical activity and fitness should increase their total calories from protein to assist in muscle recovery. Yes, definitely. And a balance of protein, carbohydrates, and fat is recommended by NASM. They always say balance, and that's typically the way that they stand. So next slide, 16, we're getting into carbohydrates. So the carbohydrates are the chief source of energy for all body functions and muscular exertion. NASM loves carbohydrates. If they ask any question on which one is the best for muscle gain, which one is the best for fat loss, you must always select carbohydrates. NASM loves to talk about carbohydrates. Carbohydrates provide 4 calories per gram, and the compounds containing carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. NASM really doesn't go into much chemistry on the test, so don't worry about that. But for most moderately active adults, a carbohydrate intake of 45 to 65% is recommended. Okay, that's just pulled straight out of the guidelines set by the American government. So we also have classifications of carbohydrates at the bottom of slide 16. We have simple carbohydrates, complex carbohydrates, and fiber. Some examples of simple carbohydrates are sugar, honey, and fruit. These are going to be your, we'll say, monosaccharides, such as glucose, fructose, and galactose. So sugar, honey, and fruit. Complex carbohydrates are more or less going to be starches, and starches are considered, starches, the storage form of carbohydrate in all plants, and those are polysaccharides. And then fiber is also a polysaccharide and considered a complex carbohydrate, but does not provide any energy to us. Good, looking over to slide 17. Simple carbohydrates are easily digested, monosaccharides and disaccharides, and they're in refined foods, or we'll say simple sugars are in simpler foods, or refined industrialized foods like white bread and candy. And complex carbohydrates are going to be found in more vegetables, we'll say. And the starch or glucose in fruits is also going to be a complex carbohydrate. But complex carbohydrates require prolonged enzymatic activity to be broken down into simple sugar form. What that basically means is that you're still getting the same amount of sugar, but it's just in a slower time. If you eat 30 grams of complex carbs versus 30 grams of simple carbs, you're still getting 30 grams of carbs. It's just a matter of, is it going to spike insulin levels or spike or increase or high on the glycemic index, or is it going to take a long time to digest and therefore provide you with consistent energy? That's what NASM is talking about. And complex carbohydrates are also polysaccharides. Starches like potatoes and other vegetables are where you get your complex carbohydrates or starch. Clicking over to slide 18, fiber and health. So NASM does like fiber as well, just like the government recommends. Higher intakes of dietary fiber are associated with lower incidence of heart disease and certain types of cancer, specifically colon cancer. Recommended daily intake of dietary fiber is 25 grams. Yes, it does say 25 to 35 on the slide, but if you were to know any number on what's the recommended intake of dietary fiber, it is 25 grams. Fiber also provides bulk to the diet in the sense that when you eat fiber, you will feel full, even though you don't get calories from that. So sometimes that can be great for someone watching their caloric intake because it's going to make them feel full without them actually eating a lot of calories. It also regulates the body's absorption of glucose in the sense that your body slowly absorbs or more slowly absorbs glucose when fiber is present. Good, clicking over to slide 19, carbohydrates and performance. No matter what, it is important for a supreme or high-performance athlete to eat carbohydrates. It is going to enhance their ability to perform, as carbohydrates can be quickly turned into energy. So let's talk about some activities on the scale of intensity. Anaerobic activity, which is high intensity, short duration, is dependent on availability of glycogen. If you have a high glycogen storage, you are going to be good at anaerobic activity, which is, we'll say, less than 30 seconds of work. Aerobic activity is longer term, typically over 2 minutes or more. Typically, NASA might say 3 minutes or more. And it is low intensity, long duration. And glycogen is going to provide 50% of the energy needs and fat the other 50%. Endurance exercise with a carbohydrate-rich diet builds glycogen stores and aids in performance and recovery, meaning that you might perform better if you have a high glycogen storage. This is where you get carbohydrate loading from, is that eating a lot of carbohydrates before endurance exercise can enhance your ability to perform. A diet containing approximately 60% of caloric intake from carbohydrate is recommended, especially for endurance, for endurance athletes, as they will be doing a lot of exercise and carbohydrates can be used for fuel during that exercise. Complex carbohydrates should make up the majority of the calories owing to the nutrient-dense nature. Clicking over to slide 20, carbohydrate recommendations. Consume a high-carbohydrate meal 2 to 3 hours before activities lasting 60 minutes or more. Let's say you have a soccer game or a run or a 5K or something that is going to last for an hour or so of endurance activity. It is good to have a high-carbohydrate meal about 2 to 3 hours before those activities. This will make sure that you aren't too full while you go into activity and you aren't hungry by any means, so right in that middle zone. Also, a liquid meal replacement formula can be an option for quick fuel during that activity. Smaller meals or liquid snacks should be consumed closer to the exercise session, which will prevent gastrointestinal distress. I'm sure everyone's had a ton of food then tried to go do something active and just not felt that great. Ensure glycogen refueling is also will assist when you eat those smaller meals closer or during exercise. All right, carbohydrate loading. Endurance events lasting 90 minutes or more deplete muscle glycogen stores, so carbohydrate loading is used to increase muscle glycogen stores before competition. An example of a high-carbohydrate food that would benefit an endurance athlete is a baked potato. Basically, NASM is going to ask you about a few different foods that are high in carbohydrates and what might be good for an endurance event or before an endurance event, and definitely a potato is going to have a ton of carbs and going to be great for exercise and activity, especially in that carbohydrate loading sense. So, looking to slide 22, there's a chart that gives an example of a glycogen loading schedule. So basically, just read it. Nothing that important on here. NASA used to have a question which just said, 6 days out, approximately how many carbohydrates should you have? And it's 4 grams per kilogram body weight. But they took that question out because I think it was just a little bit too specific. So clicking over to slide 23, they have some more carbohydrate recommendations. So during exercise, increase your carbohydrate intake for exercises lasting longer than 60 minutes. This can help supply glucose to the working muscles where glycogen stores may be depleted. And consume 20 to 40 ounces of a sports drink, blah, blah, blah. Perform carbohydrate balance, or proper carbohydrate balance contributes to enhanced performance for the endurance athlete. And most importantly, on this page, adequate carbohydrates also spare the use of protein as a fuel source, so they can contribute to sparing muscle reduction, meaning that as opposed to using muscle as a fuel, if you eat a ton of carbohydrates, you can better perform and be assisted in that performance using carbohydrates. Good, clicking over to slide 24. We have some recommendations further for carbohydrates after exercise. So repeated days of strenuous activity decrease an athlete's muscle glycogen stores. So within 30 minutes after exercise, consume 1.5 grams per kilogram body weight of carbohydrate. That is going to be important to know. So what does NASA recommend after exercise? Within 30 minutes, and that's one of the key things to that question, is that you have to know 30 minutes after exercise, or within, 1.5 grams per kilogram body weight of carbohydrate. Okay, so if I was 100 pounds, I would eat 150, or sorry, if I was 100 kilograms, that's like about a 200-pound man, maybe 220-pound man, I would eat approximately 150 grams of carbohydrates. So additional meals of 1.5 grams per kilogram body weight every 2 hours are recommended to completely restore muscle glycogen. Good. So clicking over to slide number 24. Slide number 25. Carbohydrate recommendations, continuing altering body composition. So NASM says, like I mentioned before, if you're trying to lose weight, you should eat carbohydrates. If you're trying to gain weight, you should eat carbohydrates. It's kind of contradictory in my eyes, and there are better methods of monitoring total macronutrients in order to optimize your goals. But let's go ahead and read this. Yeah, so for altering body composition, carbohydrates should make up the highest percentage of macronutrient calories during fat loss or muscle gain. The satiating value of complex carbohydrates is especially important when one is in a caloric deficit. That's kind of what I mentioned about fiber. You will be full if you're counting calories if you eat fiber. Very little data correlates carbohydrate intakes to increases in obesity. In fact, excess intake of any nutrient will cause weight gain. So that's what NASA really wants you to focus on and know, is that if you eat an excess of any macronutrient, it will cause weight gain. So it'll ask you, like, oh, which of the following macronutrients is why people gain weight? It's like, oh, actually, none of them. It's actually when any carbohydrate or any macronutrient is in excess, it will cause weight gain. Good. Looking at slide 26. Next, we have lipids. There are three types of lipids: sterols, triglycerides, and phospholipids. Let's get into those. Clicking over to slide 27. Sterols. So we know sterols as cholesterol. That's the main one that we would see it in the body. And they're naturally produced in the body, or liver, and available in foods. Lipoproteins are the cholesterol transporters of the body. We have VLDLs, LDLs, and HDLs. You do need to know that VLDLs and LDLs are considered bad cholesterol. Is that really true? There's a lot more to it. If you want to check out a book called The Cholesterol Myth, it explains it in a lot more detail as to what exactly is going on. And then HDL is going to be healthy cholesterol, or high-density lipoproteins are going to be considered healthy. Low dietary fat intake, regular exercise, and body weight regulation raise HDL. So all good things raise HDL, all bad things raise LDL. And the ratio of LDL to HDL is the current blood test used to evaluate the risk of cardiovascular disease. And that is complete crap, in my opinion, but it's what NASA wants you to know. Looking to our next type of fat or lipid, we have triglycerides. Notice, three fatty acids attached to a glycerol backbone. When you look at a fat, specifically a triglyceride, which makes up 95% of all fats that we eat. A triglyceride is a sugar or a glycerol, glycogen, glucose, glycerol means sugar, and three fatty acids. So triglyceride, okay? So three fatty acids attached to a glycerol backbone. There is sugar in fat. Interesting. And basically when you eat a very low carbohydrate diet, it is possible for that sugar, the glycerol backbone, to turn into usable fuel.